Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. President Trump talked to farmers and ranchers at the American Farm Bureau Convention in Nashville Monday, making him the first president to do so in a quarter century. American farmers are facing the greatest four-year dip in income since the Great Depression, and farmers have big questions about NAFTA, crop insurance, and high-speed internet access. This hour on Point, Trump, the family farm, and the future of rural America. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you hear President Trump's speech? What do you make of the Trump administration's agriculture policies? Joining me now from Washington is Catherine Boudreau, food and agriculture reporter for Politico. She was in Nashville for the president's speech. You can find a link to her story, Trump in Speech to Farmers Aims to Shore Up Rural Support, at our website, onpointradio.org. Catherine Boudreau, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Ray.
What are the big pending issues in America's farm communities that the president actually touched on in his speech to the Farm Bureau?
Well, the president spoke a lot about his deregulatory agenda, which is popular among farmers and ranchers. In particular, this Waters of the U.S. regulation, there was loud applause when he talked about his efforts to roll that back. The president signed an executive order at the beginning, very beginning of his time in office, which directed the EPA, which proposed the regulation during the Obama administration, and they directed the EPA to review it and either revise or rescind it. And of course, farmers and ranchers were worried about the potential of EPA coming to onto their land and potentially telling them how to farm their land and what waters would fall into the Clean Water Act. So he definitely touted that.
I noticed you used the word potentially. The original Obama era rules didn't affect farmers very heavily or directly, did they?
That's right. Well, it's tied up in the courts right now. The Supreme Court has to decide which court will settle all these challenges to the Waters of the U.S. regulation, because many states sued the Obama administration's version.
What about some of the other pressing issues? Right now, commodity prices are pretty low, and American farmers have competitors scattered around the globe in a lot of these big cereal grains.
Yes, that's right. Trump has repeatedly threatened to withdraw from the North American Free Trade Agreement, and that is really unsettling to a lot of farmers, especially in the grain and livestock sectors, because they've benefited a lot over the last 20 or so years that we've been involved in NAFTA. And this also creates a lot of uncertainty in the markets, which, you know, agribusiness traders and farmers all rely on to signal when to buy and to sell. And even just yesterday, I think Reuters was reporting that Canadian officials are pretty sure that Trump will withdraw from NAFTA. But, of course, President Trump, during his speech to the American Farm Bureau Federation, said, you know, we're looking to get a better deal for you, and we want to make sure these deals are fair. But he stopped short of promising that he will stay in the pact. And I think a lot of farmers were looking for some certainty, because Canada and Mexico are such huge markets.
If they were looking for certainty, it sounds, from what you're saying, like they didn't get it.
No, definitely not. He basically just stuck to the line that he wants to get a more fair deal for farmers and manufacturers, of course. He's spoken a lot about manufacturers and bringing back that industry to the United States along the campaign trail in this last year. So certainly no assurances that he's going to stay in the pact.
It's a funny thing. You know, a lot of people, now that such a small percentage of Americans work on or around farms, they don't realize how differently the economics of farming operate from the economics of the rest of the economy. Low interest rates, pretty big deal down on the farm where a lot of the business runs on credit. But a strong American dollar, instead of being helpful or a symbol of national pride, makes it tough when you're competing against Brazilian soybeans or Argentine wheat.
Yes, that's right. And I think farmers and ranchers during the convention that I talked to were very concerned about Mexico, for instance, as a backup plan, a plan B, buying corn and soy from, like you said, Brazil or Argentina. No longer is America just the go-to customer. Other countries are definitely trying to compete.
Let's bring in North Dakota farmer Doyle Lentz now. Doyle owns and operates Lentz Farms, a 6,000-acre family farm in Rolla, North Dakota. He farms canola, wheat, barley, and soybeans. Doyle, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's January. What's going on the farm in North Dakota at a cold time of year? What are you up to?
Well, I tell you right today, not much, Ray. It's actually a blizzard going on in most of North Dakota. It's 10 below zero with a 20 mile an hour wind. Not a very nice day, even for a native North Dakotan. It's kind of a rough day, but most of the winter we spend marketing our products that we grow through the summer months. And, of course, we work on our equipment and we make the necessary plans to start another year of planting come spring.
And I guess take account of what kind of year 2017 was. I mentioned the crops you grow. Was 2017 a good year at the Lentz family farm?
From a production standpoint, Ray, it was very good. We were fortunate to have above-average yields again this year. But, of course, when you have above-average yields, that's more product that you have to find a market for. And right now, that's our concern. We want to make sure that we have a place to sell the grain we produce. And hopefully with these trade agreements, we can continue the trek that we've been on to take advantage of our oversupply.
Well, you're probably not the only farmer who had a good year. It's a mixed blessing, isn't it? When a lot of people are doing well and creating a lot of product, which eventually lowers the price, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's what happens, Ray. Unfortunately, we're in a business where we kiddingly almost have to wish something bad on someone else somewhere else so that we can have a more profitable year.
Can you change your product mix quickly? So looking back at 2017 and looking ahead to 2018, can you change the mix of what you plant, how many acres you put into which crop to respond to changing market forces?
Well, it's kind of hard to do. We can't do it real quickly because of crop rotations. Trying to be good stewards of the environment, that's not a good practice to be flip-flopping your different crops that you put in. We try to maintain a certain type of rotation so that we can continue to do the best we can to try to conserve soil and water. So we don't like to do that unless we're forced into it. But, of course, you'll see more of this happening when the economic times demand that you do that.
What did you make of what the president had to say to you and your peers early this week?
Well, I've been at this quite a long time, over 25 years of working on policy. And, you know, as a farmer, of course, it was a feel-good speech. There's no doubt about that. You hear all the right kind of bullet points. But being the old gray-haired guy that I am, I get a little bit nervous when there's nothing of any substance in there other than, it's more like political rhetoric or like a campaign speech again. We need something firm, you know, that gives us direction so that we know that we're going to have these markets to sell into. Or as you suggested earlier, that we can plan at least to go to different types of commodities that we might be able to look for a different market for.
Did you hear any reassurance on NAFTA? And are you worried the way many farmers are as you look at your own product mix?
Well, again, I heard that rhetoric again, but I'm not completely convinced that's going to be the end all for NAFTA. When he starts mentioning some of the other industries that he's going to bring back, that kind of creates kind of a red flag for me. To say that NAFTA is important to us is very, very important. I mean, when it's our number one for me in malt barley, it's the number one malt barley export. I think number two in wheat, and it's right up there with number two with corn. And you know, these are very important crops for us. Canola, it's one of our number one export markets in canola. So we really, really need the markets to be open for us. And more importantly, we need the people in these countries to have faith in our supply.
One quick thing before we go to a break. I think since we're living in an era where so many Americans really don't understand what's going on the farm, maybe we can get really basic. When you grow these things, canola, wheat, barley, soybeans, who are you selling them to?
Well, we're selling them to our grain companies, whether it be your Cargill, the ADMs, your Harvest States, or whomever. But ultimately, those are the people that have the market that they export into. And, of course, then markets are dictated by a lot of things, whether it be infrastructure, you know, your train transportation, or whether it be, you know, you talked about currencies earlier. We have to make sure we're going into competitive markets. Sometimes the Canadians will have an advantage on us, so we have to play into those markets as well. It becomes quite complicated quite quickly, actually. And the side of malt barley, we do direct contracting with the actual malt buyers in Mexico and brewers in Mexico, which is kind of, that's very nice. That's like farm direct. And, of course, we prefer to do business like that by eliminating one of the steps. But obviously, we can't do that with our major bulk commodity.
Was the president's speech something that would cheer the hearts of those Archer Daniel Midlands and Cargills more than Doyle Lentz?
Well, I'd argue it probably has more effect on me as a producer, because those big companies are going to sell our commodities no matter where they go or what price they're at. I mean, they're gonna get so much per bushel on my farm, irregardless of where that commodity sold or at what price. They don't care if my soybeans are $6 a bushel or $16 a bushel. They're going to make their percentage off of that bushel. So, I mean, for me, it's much more important than the price, which is dictated by market relevance. I need that.
Farmer Doyle Lentz is with me from Rolla, North Dakota. Catherine Boudreau, who covers agriculture for Politico, is with me from Washington, D.C. Rural Americans, what challenges are you facing? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? And what can a tuna cannery in the middle of the Pacific tell us about taxes? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator, a new podcast from Planet Money, where in every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. President Trump took his message to rural America this week. We're taking stock of the agricultural policies making their way from Washington to the cornfield near you. You can join the conversation. Will the elimination of the estate tax keep your farm in the family? Can you survive without crop insurance? Is it time to stop subsidizing the farm industry? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with reporter Catherine Boudreau, food and agriculture reporter for Politico, and with North Dakota farmer Doyle Lentz. Catherine Boudreau, did the president, in his Nashville speech, talk about immigration?
He briefly talked about immigration. He mentioned that he wants to secure the border, which I think is a little bit unsettling to some farmers and ranchers because they rely on migrant labor to harvest their crops or work on their dairy farms across the country. So I think that there's mixed feelings among farmers and ranchers, certainly, on the president's immigration agenda.
One of the great undertold stories in American life is how, over the last 20 years, hardening the border created even larger populations of immigrant labor in agricultural areas in the country. Men who would go back and forth across the border year after year stopped doing that crossing when it became too perilous to do so. So they began to stay and find jobs to do in the winter and find jobs to do in the off season, and eventually bring their wives and girlfriends north. It's
an amazing story and one that we're not going to cover this hour, but bears some watching. Did he talk at all about climate change?
Actually, no mention of climate change really at all. He didn't. He mostly focused on the crowd pleasers, right? So talking about tax cuts, for instance, or his deregulatory agenda. And he invoked a lot of patriotism as well, which I think plays well in, you know, the heartland, because they actually send a lot of their community to the military in higher rates than in their urban counterparts, for instance.
Doyle Lentz, when you talk to your friends and colleagues in North Dakota, when you were at a regional meeting, let's say, do you talk about changing patterns of rain, of wind, of agricultural pests that may be coming along with changes in the climate?
Yeah, very interestingly enough, you know, that's one of the main topics. Weather is always the main topic for farmers. And I find it kind of interesting that we talk about weather, but we don't really want to talk about climate change very much. And I'm of the belief, you know, that whether you agree or disagree, you should at least have a discussion about this. But I'm probably in the minority with my producers out here, because a lot of them just don't want to talk about it. But I'm a science-driven type of individual, and I think we should have at least the discussion about that.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you've been at this a long time. In the 25 years that you've been farming in North Dakota, have you seen things change in your part of the state?
Oh, absolutely. I live right in north central North Dakota, right on the Canadian border. And, I mean, if somebody would have told me I could have grown soybeans here 20 years ago, I'd have probably laughed at them, right? Because, I mean, it just wasn't possible. So along come a couple of things. Our frost dates in northern North Dakota have moved back probably about 10 days, which doesn't sound like much, but it's huge when you start talking about crops. That and, of course, the biotechnology that's used in some of those crops have allowed the breeding programs to accelerate. So I'm growing soybeans here in North Dakota. It's actually about one-third of our acres are our farmer soybeans, which if my grandpa seen that today, he wouldn't know what kind of crop that even was.
Kathleen writes, the president didn't lay out a plan. He made some vague general pronouncements and can't explain the first detail about any of it. You can bet big agribusiness will be the beneficiaries. Big ag is already one of the largest recipients of federal subsidies. John writes, as he deports more illegals and fewer people cross the border because of his policies, did he offer any assistance to the farming industry as to who would help harvest the crops? Our next stop this hour, Wyawega, Wisconsin. Owen, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ray, how's it going?
Okay.
All right. So basically what we're dealing with here in Wisconsin is overproduction of milk, driving the milk prices down. It's real basic economics. You're increasing your supply, and the demand is continuing to diminish, and we continue to increase supply. Okay. So we have a lot of farmers complaining about milk prices being too low or not being able to be sustainable or meet operating costs and cash flow properly. So as a result, what I'm seeing is this. I'm an American citizen working on a larger dairy farm here in Wisconsin. There are so many undocumented workers here that provide the labor to these dairies to allow them to continue to overproduce that it makes it impossible for a family like mine to buy and operate our own farm because the prices are out of sync with the supply. Do you understand? Every illegal person that's here is making it easier for these folks to overproduce. One man, according to the university studies, can efficiently, on a very efficient operation, take care of 112 animals a day per person. And a family farm does not consist of enough people to milk 3,000 to 5,000 cattle per farm. Do you understand? The mathematics is out of whack here, but we don't have...
But Owen, let me jump in there, because I'm wondering whether you're arguing against yourself. If one man can manage over 100 head of cattle, how important is the cost of immigrant labor to the eventual gallon of milk on a store shelf? I would imagine silage, the cost of the cow, the cost of heat. There's a lot of other... No, I understand your point entirely. But I'm wondering whether, as dairy operations become more efficient, that immigrant labor is really a driver of the cost as much as you say. If you need fewer and fewer of them, I understand how it's a challenge to you because you're trying to make a living in this industry. What about the buyer in the supermarket? Are they affected at all by this? No, milk is getting is being drunk less, even though it's getting cheaper.
Right, but if you take, this is my point, if you take a family farm and it's 4 to 5 people that are the proprietors, they should only be able to capable of taking care of 500 head of cattle. So how do you figure a family farm can handle 5,000 head? Because they have a lot of undocumented labor supplementing their income, and they're becoming extremely wealthy, land wealthy and capital wealthy as far as, you know, what they're doing. Because the Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue's office, I wrote a letter. They told me in order to be efficient in agriculture and make the most return on your investment, you have to milk over 2,000 cows. And there's no way a small proprietorship consisting of 4 people in a family, say, can milk 2,000 cows without labor supply.
Ah, so the immigrant labor raises the number of head of cattle that you can run on a dairy operation.
Right, and we have no census data because Wisconsin doesn't take a census of the undocumented people. The state of Pennsylvania has estimated there's 30,000 undocumented labor from other countries working in Pennsylvania in agriculture right now, but they will not confirm that. That's just an estimate. The state of Wisconsin won't even confirm that there is any undocumented labor here.
What would happen?
Okay,
so Owen, go with me here, Owen. What would happen if tomorrow we went to Wisconsin, the United States, in force, and sent all those people home? What would happen to the farms, and what would happen to the price of milk and the profitability of farming?
Well, you wouldn't see an oversupply, I don't think.
So that would support the price?
I think that would put things back in the right, or proper natural state that it should be with economics. You oversupply, you're going to drive your prices down. People don't want low prices. They want high prices for their product. They need to be able to secure that by not oversupplying. This is crazy. Why would you want to keep oversupplying so you can get rich? Because you want to put your neighbor out of business so you can buy his land too. That's the plan. That's what these big farms are doing. They're continuing to just monopolize everything, and they're not doing it without the help of undocumented labor that's cheap, that can come in here, and they don't even have repercussions as a result of that.
Owen calling us from Wauwega, Wisconsin, with an interesting view from Ground Zero. Joining us now from Manhattan, Kansas, is Art Barnaby. He's a professor of agricultural economics at Kansas State University. Professor Barnaby, what do you think about the on-the-ground economics lesson that we just got from Owen?
Well, there are tremendous economies to scale to agriculture. Dairy is not a specialty for me, but the reality is to be a full-time wheat farmer probably takes about 3,500 acres in order to do that. Farms that are smaller, many of them have off-farm jobs or the spouse has off-farm jobs. So as sort of kiddingly saying, they have off-farm jobs to subsidize their farming habit.
But we just heard a guy telling us that because of the cheapness of immigrant labor, farms are able to get bigger than they naturally would be, which enables them to produce more product. I'm wondering if these economies apply in other kinds of farming. You mentioned that you're not an expert in dairy, but do the same sort of rules of economics apply to other kinds of production?
Certainly in the case of cash grain like wheat, it does take a larger scale, and it comes in a lot of forms. To make money with wheat today, you probably need to, in the case of Kansas, where we don't test for wheat quality, in order to really benefit from high-quality wheat, high-protein wheat, unlike North Dakota, where they test for every load that goes across the scales, here it's all bought on bulk. The exception is if you're big enough to have your own on-farm storage, and I'm not talking about just a sealed bin, I mean essentially your own elevator, to maintain that high-quality wheat, keep it in condition, and sell directly to a miller. That takes size and scale. The other thing is that when I was growing up on a farm, combine might have 12 or 13-foot platform. You know, the reel on the front of the combine, they can be close to 40 feet wide now. You can cut more wheat in a day than we used to cut in a week. So all of that is due to size of equipment. We also have a lot of folks that come through custom cutting. So in that case, it's that temporary shortage of combines maybe, where you wouldn't necessarily have to own them all, which can get you to a very large scale. For the most part, the labor is probably not a big issue when it comes to those grains.
Art Barnaby joins us from Manhattan, Kansas. He's a professor of agricultural economics at Kansas State University. He joins us along with Catherine Boudreau from Politico and farmer Doyle Lentz in North Dakota. Morganton, North Carolina is next. Megan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Okay.
So I teach agriculture actually at the community college level. I'm an instructor. And in Western North Carolina, our agricultural community is largely small, diversified farms. We don't have a lot of commodity production with the exception of maybe industrialized poultry. And what I see missing from everything being proposed by the president is support and focus on farmer education, bringing up the next generation of farmers because farmers are largely aging out. And also focusing on these diversified farms in areas that are not these huge commodity-driven farms. I think the previous guest cited something like 3,500 acres, which is unheard of. Where we are, 100 acres here is a large farm. And so there's this giant gap in what's being proposed because where are next generation of farmers coming from? Where are the fruits and vegetables that largely make it into our local food system coming from? They're coming from these small farms. They're not coming from these commodity-driven farms. And we won't have those things if the government doesn't support them and leaves them to the wayside.
I was with a bunch of farmers in northwestern Iowa a couple of years ago, sitting having breakfast at a diner, big table. And I said to all of them, do any of your children want to eventually own and operate your farm? And they all looked at each other and almost to a man, they said no.
It's true, and it's a huge struggle. And so we work with our students. Our program at Western Piedmont Community College is largely technical and experiential learning. So we're teaching them to operate the equipment. We're teaching them the processing and value-added product development. And we're going from square one with these students. And some of them are coming from an ag background, but some of them have never set foot on a farm before being in our program. And it's so important. And it's a huge deficit to not focus on that at the federal level because eventually, you know, these farmers who have been doing it for 30 and 40 years won't be doing it anymore. And their families will not be taking it over because they realize that farming is unforgiving. It is a hard life and it's enriching if you can stick with it, and if you have community support, and you have industry support, and you have government support. But when those things are missing, it's like taking a beating every day. You know, not a lot of people go back for it. And that just has to be, some attention needs to be paid to that. We're going to be in a lot of trouble, I think, as a country within the next decade or so, because there won't be young people coming up behind these experienced farmers to take over where they're leaving off.
Megan's from Morganton, North Carolina. Catherine Boudreau, those kinds of issues, the ones that Megan just brought up, were they dominating conversations away from the president's speech at the Farm Bureau gathering?
Certainly. Not only just at the Farm Bureau convention in Nashville, but I hear these concerns all the time when I'm talking to farmers and ranchers and policymakers here in Washington, making sure that the next generation of farmers can come back or even start up their own operation. But really, the barriers are cost of land, the amount of capital you need to start a farm, the investment. I mean, equipment is super expensive. And also student loan debt is a huge issue, too. I mean, if you're graduating college with a ton of loans, it's difficult to go to a banker and say, please invest in me because I'm going to make it work. And so you don't have these long established relationships with a banker who can say, yes, I trust you. I know your history. So those are all barriers that I know lawmakers here in Washington are talking about and in the context of the Farm Bill, which needs to be reauthorized by September 30th. But I personally haven't heard any great long-term solutions to address this issue.
It's been helping that interest rates are pretty low, though, hasn't it?
That's I've heard multiple times that the low interest rates are a saving grace, and also just these relationships that older farmers have with their farm, their banker in these rural communities, because they will, you know, extend their loan a little bit longer and they have those relationships.
We're talking about President Trump's message to rural America, from high-speed internet access to NAFTA. You can join the conversation. Would bringing high-speed internet access to your town bring more prosperity to a rural area? I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point.
Each and every morning, there are a whole lot of places you can look for news. Try this instead, though. Listen to Up First. Up First is the morning news podcast from NPR. One tap, and 10 minutes later, you have started the day informed. Find Up First on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about family farms and farm policy. President Trump spoke to the challenges for farmers and rural America in a speech earlier this week. You can join the conversation. Rural Americans, what do you need? What's keeping you up at night? Here was the president in Nashville on Monday, promising he would get American producers better trade terms with Canada and Mexico than NAFTA currently does.
To level the playing field for our great American exporters, our farmers and ranchers, as well as our manufacturers, we're reviewing all of our trade agreements to make sure that they are fair and reciprocal. Reciprocal, so important. On NAFTA, I am working very hard to get a better deal for our country and for our farmers and for our manufacturers. It's under negotiation as we speak.
President Trump earlier this week. I'm talking with Catherine Boudreau, food and agriculture reporter for Politico, North Dakota farmer Doyle Lentz, and Art Barnaby, agricultural economist at Kansas State University. And they're joined by Eric, calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to On Point, Eric.
Hi, Ray. Yeah, I guess my point is with the removal, the withdrawal of the TPP, we're absent at the WTO for the most part, and then we have our NAFTA trade agreement, which the president or Trump has insulted the Mexicans, insulted the Canadians. Where are they going to market their products at now? You know, their input costs are higher than they got $17 a hundred milk input costs, and they're $13, $14 a hundred in the market. They've got big problems coming down the pike unless they eliminate the middleman and direct market. You know what kind of a trend of things are? Dairy producers are not selling the milk to the cheese plant. They're making micro dairies or micro dairies and producing cheese or Greek yogurt or specialty cheese, you know. So I think they've got a real tough time coming myself.
Doyle Lentz, that's your cue. When we look at the international scene and we look at the reliance of American producers on selling internationally, you mentioned Mexico and selling to beer producers down there. Let's talk a little bit more about the role of Canada, which, if the projections are correct, will become more competitive in various kinds of grains as Canadian climes continue to warm.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the climate thing has been affecting it as well. One of the main crops in Manitoba is flax. It was like their number three most grown crop. That's been surpassed now by soybeans in less than 4 years. So that tells you right there that the soybeans are running rampant in Manitoba, which is, you know, people kind of forget there's a whole country above the United States. And, of course, they're going to have to go somewhere with these beans, and primarily because of infrastructure, that's probably going to be going to the Pacific Rim with a large portion of them, which that's going to directly affect me. Again, we're out of the TPP, so There's added duties and tariffs, and Canada's going to be right there to take advantage of them along with their favorable exchange rate. So those are the type of things that are going to affect these markets. For me to go into the Canadian market, when my barley doesn't make quality for the malting industry, it's used as a feed. And since there's limited livestock in our part of the country, the natural place to get rid of that feed barley would be into Canada with their hog production and beef production. So I could have the potential to lose that market as well. So that's my outlet for marginal quality crops.
We'll go next to Alma, Georgia. David's on the line. David, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Ray.
What's on your mind, David?
Okay, I'm a blueberry farmer from South Georgia, and I was at the American Farm Bureau Convention along with Peggy Lee from Bacon County. And anyway, we farm blueberries, and I've done it for 40 years or plus. But we're getting more and more competition from companies like Driscoll and Nature Ripe, and all these guys have moved to Mexico, aiming at especially the Florida and South Georgia market in production, and they use slave labor. You can cut it and dice it any way you want to, because I know the families that come back and forth, they had it basically $1 an hour, and we're like at $15 an hour, and all kinds of regulations. The Waters of the U.S. has put some of my neighbor farmers out of business with their regulations and everything. So, hey, I trust President Trump. I mean, he's going to do the right thing for the American farmer. I don't care if it's a wheat farmer or a corn farmer or what kind of farmer. And I know they're all in trouble. Dairy farmers, my gracious, how are they going to survive? And the family farm, I mean, you got to make a profit. And that's the main thing I heard President Trump say. Hey, y'all businesses, y'all got to make a profit to stay in business. And I hooped and hollered more then than I ever have in my life. And I tell you, I support Donald Trump. I mean, I just support him 100%. And, yeah, some of his tweets are a little bit, I don't understand some of that. But anyway, I trust him. And Sonny Perdue, I've known him since he was state senator. And, of course, Zippy Duval, Zippy and Bonnie's been on my farm. They've been in my labor house, and they know me. And David Perdue, and you know, anyway, the folks with that's connected with the political scene, I mean, trust us, I think that Georgia, Sonny Perdue, and the connection he has with Zippy Duval and on up to Donald Trump, I just think that's going to be a working positive thing for not only the Georgia, but also the North Dakota and all over the world.
David, let me ask you a quick question. You mentioned the slave wages and the low wages in some of your competitors. If you want to follow American law to the letter and play it straight and just bring in temporary laborers when you need them to work on your farm, is it easy to do? Or is it a difficult thing to thread the needle and get the men when you need them?
Oh, it's almost impossible. And going back, I was a tobacco farmer, and I've been to Canada to crop tobacco. I know what migrant labor. I was a migrant laborer, so I know how it was. But now they treated us, I mean, good. I mean, I love the Canadian farmers, and Canadian people are great. But on the Canadian side, they have the frozen blueberries, and I'm one of the owners of AlmaPack. We have an IQF plant. It does 10, 15 million pounds of blueberries. Well, the frozen berries, Canada has a process where they just dump frozen berries on the American market by the hundreds of thousands of tons. I mean, just millions of pounds of blueberries. And it just has killed our price. So we got to be able to compete in a level playing field. That's what I've been to Brazil and Argentina and all these folks. Hey, if you level the playing field, I think the American farmer will be there and be able to do the right thing and feed this country with safe.
David calling from Alma, Georgia. Art Barnaby, listening to David, I'm almost reminded of how hard it is to have a general conversation about American agriculture because wool and pork and blueberries and dairy and soybeans are almost different worlds to each other in many ways.
They absolutely are. The economics are very different from the large-scale grain farmers that we have in Kansas. And by large scale, I mean larger than a lot of other parts of the country. Large is a relative term. You know, even the farms that have 5 and 10,000 acres, most of those are family operations. They're not corporations per se. But nonetheless, yes, it's a very diverse agriculture and very different markets that they're selling into. One of the numbers I like to throw out to an urban audience is back when we were selling wheat at a profit 4 or 5 years ago, wheat was bringing, you know, $7-$8 a bushel. There's only a dime's worth of actual wheat in that loaf of bread that they bought at the grocery store. Today, the bottom's fallen out of the market, and that really gets complicated because it's even worse than what it shows up on the Board of Trade. But nonetheless, at today's prices, there's somewhere around a nickel, maybe a little less than a nickel worth of wheat in a loaf of bread. And I doubt that very many consumers saw any change in the bread price in their store, and if they did, they probably didn't even notice it.
How would you explain that to people? How do you help people understand that what they're paying at their local supermarket, the Vons, the Ralphs, the Stop and Shop, the Piggly Wiggly, where depending on where you are in the country, they don't see very much. When you say the bottom has fallen out of the wheat market, the bottom hasn't fallen out of the price of a loaf of bread.
You know, the wheat market's dropped by 50% from those high years. So, yes, it's a very small part of it. What I was going to say is things like the previous gentleman talking about blueberries, you know, those are consumed directly into the market, not much processing there, at least to my knowledge, and I'm speaking about things I don't know a lot about. But when you get into fruits and vegetables, there is a more direct tie between farmer prices and what's charged in the store. But on things like bread and you know, a box of cornflakes, there's not much corn in that box.
Let's go next to Rice Lake, Wisconsin. Rana is with us now. Rana, welcome to On Point.
Wow, thank you so much for taking my call. Hey, I wanted to just add in that I'm an agri-science teacher in a very rural community up here. We have 312 in our school. I actually teach in Clayton. One of our biggest problems is the bandwidth we have coming into our school. We don't have enough internet access here in rural America. Even in our home, what we're able to get isn't at the speed that you're able to get in other parts of the country. And it really, really is a hindrance for us in being able to bring in at school, let's say, certain classes that we want to be able to teach or to add-ons or for kids to be able to have access. There's some days when kids can't use their laptops because the internet's down or there's not enough bandwidth because we're teaching also some classes through what's called ITV. It's a real problem. As far as being an instructor goes, for me, I also teach some welding and other classes. So those days I can take the kids out to the shop and we've always got something to do, but some of the other teachers are a little more, it's more difficult for them. And we really need more increased internet access out here in farmland.
Catherine Boudreau from Politico, did President Trump bring any good news on that front to the Farm Bureau meeting?
Yeah, the president made a commitment to deploying rural broadband across the country. And it's true, you know, only 39% of rural Americans are really without high-speed internet access. So we signed 2 presidential orders to make it easier to for the, like, permitting process and for infrastructure, for example. And he also kind of endorsed this task force report that he directed at the beginning of his term to kind of identify the problems facing economic growth in rural America, and access to rural broadband was number one. I will note, though, that all these recommendations about deploying rural broadband are things that the government has already been doing, and there was no pledge for additional funding for these initiatives yet. So maybe down the road they'll put an estimate on it. come up with some more resources. But at this point, it sounds like they're going to continue the work that the government has already been doing.
Doyle Lentz, farmers that I've spoken to have said that they rely very heavily on broadband because they're constantly checking commodity prices from the cab of their agricultural equipment.
Yeah, we use the market all the time. We live off of the iPad and the smartphone as we work out in the rural areas. Unfortunately, when I get back to my office at the farm, I don't have any high-speed internet there. We have to rely on cell phones the rest of the time or cell towers, which are marginal at best. So it's a complicated problem to have out here in rural America. Unfortunately, we also need the funding, as Catherine mentioned. I mean, now all the good intentions in the world don't come unless the funding comes with it so that we can actually get this up and running.
We'll go to Fairmount, Georgia for the last stop this hour. Alex is with us now. Alex, welcome.
All right. Thanks for taking the call. I've been listening a lot. My heart goes out to that lady in North Carolina because she was talking about smaller producers. I recently, I'm a middle-aged man who about 5 years ago made the hard decision to get into the agriculture field. And the one thing I could speak from experience here is that, and I mean in the most respectful way, that America is ignorant to the barriers of entry to the farming industry. We have this American Gothic image stuck in our head of mom and pop out there, and it is a myth. It is no longer, a reality in this country that most of these producers, when we talk commodities, these people are making well into the six figures. These operations are valued into eight figures. And to talk to anyone about entering this market is just insane. I mean, you cannot even grasp the concept of trying to even begin saving, and no one will finance you to do it if you just want to enter this on a small-scale project. And these larger producers thrive on cheaper labor. And that's a fact of the matter. And the milk discussions earlier point to the fact that we're supporting this glut of unprofitable business in America. I hate to say this, and I apologize to everyone out there who may be hurt by this, but it might be time for some natural selection and to let these mega outfits out there like the Archer Daniel Midlands and all those folks, they need to be culled, and we need to take another look at this and where we're really headed, especially when you think about some of the topics that were brought up, like bandwidth and tractors, for instance.
Well, Alex,
never even would have, or drones and all this stuff. And my heart goes out to the smaller producers out there, and I believe that we just have a lack of focus on
Alex from Fairmount, Georgia. Catherine Boudreau from Politico's Food and Agriculture coverage, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Art Barnaby, professor of agricultural economics at Kansas State University. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And Doyle Lentz, owner and operator of Lentz Farms in Rolla, North Dakota. It was great having you with us. Continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast coming up tomorrow, the Week in Review. I'm Ray Suarez. It's On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.